London.
The United Nations Aid Chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Program has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country.
As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana.
Despite a statement by Lebanon's Interior Minister Bassam Maulawi last week directing security forces to cancel any event critical of the Bahraini regime, prominent Bahraini opposition group Al-Wifaq held its scheduled event. The event, titled United for Justice, marked 11 years since Bahrain witnessed popular uprising demanding justice and political freedom.
As Bahraini opposition and Bahraini factions, we are working on unifying our stances. What unites us is more than what divides us. We're united in our cause, and our demands for justice and freedom are one.
Those who support the Bahraini opposition believe that the Bahraini people struggle for freedom, and any people's uprising for the sake of reform is similar to the Palestinian people's struggle for liberation from the Israeli occupation.
The struggle to face the forging of people's will and theft of their rights and resources, and the hijacking of political decision, as well as fighting for human rights in Bahrain, are similar to facing the Zionist enemy in Palestine and facing corruption and wrong in Lebanon and facing the conspiracy in Syria. This is one confrontation and one battle. The Bahraini normalization of ties and the visit of the Israeli Prime Minister prove what we have been calling for in the last 10 years.
The political representatives and Muslim clerics attending the event stressed that as Lebanon has always been a place for freedom of speech, opposition members of any country, as well as the Bahraini opposition groups, should be allowed to come here and speak. In addition to a violent crackdown on peaceful protesters, the Bahraini regime has now taken the lead in its normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, thereby going against its people's main cause. Experts believe this issue could further energize the Bahraini opposition in its struggle to be heard. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalise schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
The Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized, I've been vilified, and the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Sadhika, a 12th grade student in New Delhi, is outraged. She says it could perhaps be the first time in Indian history a particular community is being targeted for what they wear. Earlier, it would be our mosques, what we eat, our marriages, our personal laws. Now it's what we wear.
Being an Indian, we are very proud to be here. And we feel like every human being has a right to decide. They have their own choice. We don't need to interfere between their choices. The Constitution also gives us right there like that.
Last week, a video circulating on social media became a sensation within a few hours. A young college student from the southern Indian state of Karnataka was heckled by a group of saffron-clad Hindu students chanting slogans hailing Hindu deity Rama. The girl responded back with a similar reaction, chanting Allah Akbar, which means God is great. The incident blazed the public sentiments, with many calling the girl lioness, while others hailed her an Iron Lady. As India's state elections are underway, experts say polarizing the voters is a common phenomenon in India, with religion being the easy tool.
All effort is to try to erase Muslims from public places and to prevent them from being seen in public and impose apartheid on Muslim women. They are trying to achieve that target, but it's not as easy as they are thinking.
Another college student who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the ruling BJP might rewrite the constitution, considering their policies and actions they are imposing in a country.
It's the personal choice of a person to wear whatever they want to do, and according to constitution, we have the rights. It's totally a sad thing, and it's really like particularly targeting a particular community due to which we start living in a threat.
Ban on Islamic handscarves has outraged the Muslim community, saying it's an outright attack on their faith, which the constitution guarantees to safeguard. They say it could perhaps be an attempt to prevent Muslim women from attaining education or to flare communal tensions amid elections. Observers say anti-Muslim rhetoric has flared aggressively since BJP formed the government in 2014. They say since 2014, most of the elections in India were overly polarized. Religious divide has been the main triumph card of the current administration. Based on rights groups, the ruling BJP has adopted various laws and policies that legitimize violence and targeting religious minorities. Experts say it's a larger political agenda to make India a supremacist Hindu nation. Meanwhile, protesting student groups have defended the use of hijab, saying the constitution guarantees them religious freedom. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This, as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has called one of its most recent achievements flying an advanced drone on a 40-minute reconnaissance mission over Israel. Is this a sign that the once invincible Israeli army is not invincible anymore? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Israel's military capabilities have not been able to shield it from the resistance group's firepower, which include Hamas, and how it would not be able to withstand a war with Hezbollah. Let's find out more about this particular development from our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who joins us from Beirut. Well, Mariam, this particular piece of news is pretty amazing in itself. I don't know if you have details behind this drone that flew 40 minutes into Israeli airspace and back. What do we know about this?
Well, we know that it flew for, like you said, 40 minutes, but also 70 kilometers deep within the territories of northern Palestine. And as you said, that in and of itself is very significant development. Strategic experts believe that this is very significant when it comes to the actual face-off between Hezbollah and the Israelis. This is on one hand, of course, as you know, the drone was named Hassan after the founder of this unit in Hezbollah. This is a unit of experts that are basically have an expertise in building, making, and as we know right now, of course, making their own drones and maintaining and flying those drones in order to use them, of course, in any sort of combat. But now what we have is that the Israelis are taking the war towards Hezbollah is taking this to the Israelis themselves. But what is even more significant, we learned from the Israeli Yedioth Ahronot daily, from their website platform, that this also coincided with a maneuver that was taking place by the Israeli army, which simulated a possible Hezbollah drone attack. So that in itself, ironically, shows that Hezbollah seemed to know, first of all, about those maneuvers. Second of all, they were sending a message to the Israelis that you cannot stop our drones from actually entering. So we had the Iron Dome, we had the F-16 fighter jets. They could not intercept that drone, which could have not just been there for surveillance and reconnaissance and for spying. It could also have been for the sake of even conducting a military operation. So all of these issues put in light, and it seems that, as experts are saying, Hezbollah has taken the face-off with the Israelis to a very higher level right now.
Thank you for that, Mariam Saleh. We appreciate it. Our correspondent there from Beirut. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have activist and political commentator Leif Mahuv joining us from Beirut. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joins us from London.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Leif, I'm going to start with you. So what are we looking at over here? A reconnaissance mission that took 40 minutes and it was 70 kilometers. It was a drone and it went over Israel. I mean, it couldn't get any better for Hezbollah as a success. What do you see the different, messages this sends from the capabilities to what then it means for Israel?
Let's remember that this came just a few days after the speech of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, on the commemoration of the Leader Martyrs Day. And in that speech, he warned the Zionists that the resistance in Lebanon has acquired the capabilities to upgrade all its dumb missile stockpile, the ones that are not guided missiles, and have done so, and also are capable of building their own drones, and they're ready for business to sell these drones. And so much of the jokes on the social media in Lebanon have been that this was a test run for a drone for somebody who wants to buy it. from Hezbollah. So this shows you the difference in readiness between the resistance and the Zionist entity for the next war. This comes also, of course, in the speech. Sayyid Nasrallah pointed out that they're activated their air defenses and that they're ready to take down any Israeli drones that cross into Lebanon. And now we have that warning by Sayyid Nasrallah being juxtaposed against the reality of Hezbollah being able to breach the airspace of the Zionist entity. The next coming war, there'll be hundreds of these drones. They'll take out all the positions of the Zionist forces in North Palestine in minute easily without being taken down. And this has been shown to us by this trip with this drone, 70 kilometers. That means it almost reached Jenin in the Northwest Bank, which means that even in a war that includes Gaza, the West Bank, inside Palestine, Hezbollah could be a big factor in any next war inside Palestine, even if it doesn't spill into Lebanon.
Say, Muhsin Abbas, so you have all of that that our guest just said there on the one side, and on the other side, on the other hand, you have the fact that Israeli, whether it was their security systems or their so-called Iron Dome system or whatever other machinery or military capabilities they have, was not able to down this drone. What does that say about the Israeli apparatus as a whole?
Well, it says that steadily Israel's erstwhile propaganda and image of invincibility as a military power in the region is all but shattered. The fact is that the only superiority they now have is the nuclear one, which they don't admit, but they've got plenty of nuclear weapons. But who are they going to use those on? Hezbollah is not a conventional army. It doesn't fight in the conventional sense, although in Syria they've now acquired huge expertise, not only in terms of working with other conventional armies, but also in foreign territories, and also acquiring the skills to use the most sophisticated UAV and ballistic missile technology. Israel really is now in a total quandary, because they know that not only is the technology rapidly increasing, but they failed with all those bombing expeditions they supposedly were doing in Syria, which they no doubt they were violating. The whole purpose of those apparently was to prevent Hezbollah getting this technology or having the ability to do this. But in reality, Israel's defense mechanisms are being exposed. It's very easy now to envisage Hezbollah being able to send the UAVs in swarms to, say, for instance, the Haifa port, and completely knocking out an entire sort of lifeline for Israel. So this has huge implications.
Well, the focus is on this Israeli Iron Dome system, so-called Iron Dome system, Leith Maruf, in one sense, as it to have failed once again, which Israel so highly touts it, the purpose and function, which obviously it's not doing what it's supposed to do. First of all, why is that happening? What does that say about the security that Israel does not have as a result of this not functioning properly?
You know, the Zionist entity is not only built on mythology that doesn't have anything to do with history of the region in terms of creating this mythology of a Jewish state. It also, most of its story that is sold to the rest of the world is mythology, including this idea that it is a strong nation with huge technological advancements. All of that is a myth. The reality is, without direct American interference, even in 1973, the Zionist entity would have collapsed in the face of the Syrian and Egyptian army at the time. So what we have right now is a fragile colony that doesn't have direct support of the army of the United States, because the U.S. is busy trying to create war with China and Russia, and the resistance is showing clearly that in this moment of exit of the Americans from Western Asia, it will be very easy to take out this colony and liberate the lands of Palestine, Syria, Lebanon from these colonists.
On the other hand, we have Hamas that I'd like to point out here, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, in which in its most recent war, we saw not only their firepower to have increased dramatically in terms of not only the number of missiles, but also it traveling further into Israel and, again, penetrating this so-called Iron Dome system, which failed to bring down all the missiles. Even according to the stats given by Israel itself, of the more than 4,360 rockets and mortar attacks by Palestinian armed groups, 3,573 penetrated Israeli airspace. So something is going on that Israel is not able to stop these missiles.
Yes, it's quite clear that the systems that they have are not adequate. They're not up to the task. We've seen this also in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia with the Yemeni Ansarullah and what they've been able to penetrate in terms of taking out American systems as well, which is where the Israelis largely have got a lot of these kind of, defensive batteries, supposedly. There's also the failure of UAE. So what you're seeing is that the actual collapse of supposedly, really efficient technological defense capabilities right across the region. And that's going to encourage the resistance axis hugely. I mean, the fact is that already Hezbollah proved in 2003, 2006, that actually Israel as a military unit doesn't even have the morale or the training or the willpower to be able to last beyond a handful of days. They did that with Hamas as well. They didn't dare invade. Let's not forget, even though Hamas penetrated the Iron Dome, Israel could not pluck up the courage to launch an offensive on Gaza. Now, that's just probably the weakest part of the entire resistance axis. Hezbollah is kind of obviously slightly stronger than them. 100,000 is what Sayyid Nasrallah says in terms of military boots on the ground that they have. Just recently, he pointed that after the Tayuna incident. He's also made it clear that Hezbollah is now capable of seeing and observing all of the kind of defense mechanisms that Israel has, and they will surprise him. He's actually said over and over again that we will surprise you as to how much we know and what we can do. Add to this, the defense systems that Hezbollah itself has, and they're capable of operating all sorts of light infantry and armored weaponry, of course, all the weapons that actually, the missile weapons that took out the tanks that Israel has. Israel still hasn't found solutions to those problems. And any further engagement with Hezbollah or Hamas, I think, is only going to increasingly expose just how frail they are. And don't forget, the recruits that Israel has, their own military has admitted that the soldiers they have are just not motivated or able to come up to the same levels as the resistance. I mean, you've got to really count also the individual morale and the spiritual and religious willpower of the likes of Hezbollah and the rest of the resistance axis. They have a just cause. They have a burning in their heart for liberating Al-Quds, not just as a Palestinian land, but also as a spiritual home.
Yeah, just a side note here, which is quite ironic, Laith Maruf, is that Israel is going around trying to sell this so-called Iron Dome missile system to some of the Arab countries that they've so-called normalized with them. And it's that's beyond words when it's not working for them, that how that can work for these some of these Persian Gulf Arab countries.
Yeah, I mean, it shows you also how little control these vessels and the Gulf have of their money, because everybody knows how actually useless these weapons are. We already saw the war last year on Palestine and how useless these Israeli systems were in stopping the missiles of the resistance in Gaza. And still they're being forced to put money into it. I don't think they even have a choice. They're being told what to do. The other thing that we need to connect here is that, remember, during the war last year on Palestine, the resistance said that there was at least eight different drones flying in over the whole battlefield of historic Palestine and monitoring all the movements of the Israeli army from the joint control room that included Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas from here, from Lebanon. So if during that 11-day war, the whole movement of the Zionists was monitored by 8 drones in the air all the time, and none of those drones were shot down except one, if we remember, at the end of the war, that means that it's game over in terms of the ability of the Zionists to do any movement on the ground without being targeted.
I'd like to capitalize on that a little bit. You did talk about it, say, Mohsen Abbas, the fact that there's no desire amongst Israeli soldiers. And this was kind of confirmed by this officer, Israeli officer, that made quite a stir within Israeli media when he came out and said Israeli military not ready for war. And he mentioned the fact that the morale is very low. That's a whole other topic, I think, as to why the morale is low. But obviously, if we take a look at the different components of the army, if you have the weakened state of Israeli military capabilities along with an army that does not have the morale, then what are you left with in case there's a war?
Well, that's why I think Israel is doing everything it can to avoid war. What it wants to do is create a kind of an asymmetric war using the likes of the UAE, Saudi Arabia. They'd rather have a buffer zone, and they'd rather use what I term the Zio-Arabian monarchs to do their dirty work. But the reality is, in any war that Israel engages with the resistance, it's been proven already that Saudi Arabia and the likes of the UAE can't even take on Ansarullah and the force that exists there. And of course, Israel has its eye on the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's its real target. And what hope does Israel stand if it's going to rattle the tail of the Islamic Republic of Iran, given it can't even deal with those forces on the ground, which people call the proxies of Iran? In reality, they're resistance forces that have risen up indigenously, and it's also a reality that whether it's the Russians or the Iranians or others who are in the business of selling weapons, the Americans sell weapons as well, perfectly within their rights. But all of these resistance groups are faring rather well, I would say, in a toe-to-toe battle with the proxies of Israel, and that's exactly what Saudi Arabia is, and it's exactly what all of the other Arab monarchies are. It's really time for those monarchies, I think, to assess the partnerships that they're building up. They've seen very clearly that they can offer them very little protection. You can see that these days, with modern technological warfare as it is, just the example that you need to look at is the one in Nagorno-Karabakh and the way technology was used there. You can see that if you have this kind of technology, you can inflict absolutely a huge devastation very accurately. The Islamic Republic of Iran proved that with Ayn al-Assad as well, and the Americans and the Israelis know very well exactly what they're capable of. And I would say whatever Islamic Republic of Iran has, it's not too far in the distance future, and perhaps it already exists, that a reality will be that Hezbollah and Hamas will have exactly the same technology. Now, that is going to really put the cat amongst the pigeons, and the Israeli military men have to really reconsider exactly what any war would imply. And it may well be at some stage where the Palestinians just become so fed up with the kind of injustices that's gone on. Would you really blame them for going on an offensive war once that they are fully capable and loaded with all the necessary weaponry? I certainly wouldn't begrudge them after 70 years of the kind of injustice that Israel has inflicted. And certainly now, its military and its other capabilities are showing massive vulnerabilities.
Well, I'm sure that based on the last war, since we saw the resistance factions inside Gaza to have increased not only the number of missiles, as I mentioned before, and its range, that they are on their path to obviously complete their arsenal and advance it, whether it's technologically or otherwise. But you know, what's very interesting here, Laith Maruf, is when you take a look at Israel, it and I'm trying to put things into context and then ask you to do that for us, really, is we see Israel attack Syria, and we see Israel, without really thinking about the ramifications, attack Gaza. Does Israel not put into its calculations that if the resistance factions or resistance groups out of Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Hamas, if they were to turn all, and then to mention Hezbollah, if they were to all turn against Israel, that Israel risks its own national security? Because, you know, it's doing that by attacking Syria.
Yeah, I mean, look, the problem that the Zionists have is the contradiction between their ideal in their head. They believe that they are supreme, that they are the chosen people, and the reality on the ground, which says that they're not, militarily speaking, right now specifically. So what does this mean? That means that their supremacy is contradicting with the assessment, military assessment, that is given to them, which without direct American war against, for instance, the whole region in a next war, because we heard the Axis of Resistance leaders all speak after the last war on Palestine, saying that they're ready to join in any next war to help. So we know that this is going to happen if there is another war in Palestine, and it surely will come very soon, looking at the situations on the ground. And so at the same time, we have to also realize that it may be not necessary that, you know, Iran, for instance, enter a next war in Palestine. Maybe the Palestinians will be by that point with just a few external helping hands, you know, be able to liberate Palestine without the need for a regional war. And in terms of where we started this conversation, we mentioned the nukes of Israel. Those nukes are useless, honestly. They're just a good, you know, a shiny trophy on the shelf, because attacking Syria or Lebanon with nukes means nuclear fallout on the Zionist colony itself, and it means also targeting of the Muna reactor, which is blowing it up is like blowing a nuke. So it's a mutual destruction. So there, you know, nukes we should not be worried about, and the liberation is coming soon.
Thank you for that. We're going to end it there. Laith Maruf from Beirut, activist and political commentator. Say Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure. Thank you for your input. Journalist and political commentator from London. And we had Mariam Saleh, correspondent at the top of the spotlight. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration is threatening the well-being of millions of Afghans, while also undermining the ability of civil society organizations to respond to the crisis, says Ashley Submanian Montgomery Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. is effectively stealing billions from a nation ravaged by a U.S.-initiated war. Stay tuned for more. President Joe Biden recently declared a national emergency in the name of addressing the dual threats of the massive humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Afghanistan, as well as the potential for a deepening economic collapse in Afghanistan. In sharp contrast, his decision to unilaterally assert the U.S. authority to redistribute $7.1 billion of Afghanistan's frozen funds as it sees fit was dead wrong. In declaring the national emergency, the president laid out his administration's vision for Afghanistan's funds, should U.S. courts voice their approval, that half be made available pending litigation to the families of 9/11 victims who have claims against Taliban for its role in harboring al-Qaeda. The remaining $3.5 billion would go towards humanitarian efforts. Setting aside the moral and political problems inherent in the U.S. effectively stealing billions of dollars from a nation ravaged by a U.S.-initiated war and the resulting humanitarian and economic devastation, the president's failure to make any of these funds immediately available to the people of Afghanistan in their hour of need is unforgivable. In abdicating responsibility to the courts, which may take months to decide how these frozen funds can be redistributed, the Biden administration is threatening the well-being of millions of Afghans, while also undermining the ability of civil society organizations to respond to the crisis. This is in direct opposition to the beacon of human rights the United States claims to be. To say that Afghanistan is in urgent need is to understand the severity of the situation. 24 million Afghans, nearly 60% of the population, need humanitarian aid. Some 23 million face acute food insecurity, meaning their lives are in immediate danger. And over 1 million children are at risk of death due to severe acute malnutrition. While Afghanistan has faced humanitarian challenges for years as a result of conflict, U.S. occupation and natural disasters, the current situation is markedly worse, in no small part due to U.S. policies towards Afghanistan in the wake of the takeover. When the Taliban took control of the country last August, the Biden administration froze $7.1 billion in Afghanistan's foreign reserves held in the U.S., money that belongs to the Afghan people. And that prior to the takeover, the Central Bank of Afghanistan, that is the Afghanistan Bank, had been using to maintain economic stability. The resulting liquidity crisis has led to massive inflation alongside depreciation of the Afghani, whose value the Central Bank can no longer stabilize by selling off its foreign reserves. Many banks in Afghanistan have dramatically limited the amount of money account holders can withdraw, while others have closed entirely. Businesses no longer able to pay their employees have shuttered, leading to rampant unemployment. The price of food has risen, while the value of the Afghani has plummeted, leading to mass starvation.
As a further result of freezing these funds and U.S. sanctions that have led risk-averse banks to severely limit access to financial services in Afghanistan, local and international aid groups and other civil society organizations in Afghanistan are struggling to pay their staff and provide services to the millions of Afghans in need. Kate Phillips Barroso, Director of Humanitarian Policy at Interaction, a network of humanitarian aid organizations, recently explained that financial service providers just don't want to get involved. There is a lot of risk aversion. Financial institutions say, even with explicit permission, it still reeks of efforts and risk, and it's better to just not provide the service. As a result, aid organizations are turning to informal cash transfer networks, which entail greater risk and higher fees. Some have also turned to cryptocurrency as another means of getting funds into the country, despite challenges arising from limited use of cryptocurrency among much of the population. While these workarounds have offered some relief, limited access to cash and financial services is still plaguing the humanitarian aid sector as a direct result of U.S. policy. The Biden administration must urgently reconsider and correct its policies towards Afghanistan, and towards Afghanistan's foreign reserves in particular. Shah Mehrabi, a member of the Supreme Council of Afghanistan Central Bank and a professor of economics at Montgomery College, has called on the U.S. administration to allow the Central Bank of Afghanistan limited, monitored, and conditional access to $150 million per month from Afghanistan's foreign reserves, citing the central bank's independence from the Afghan government and the U.S. ability to monitor how the funds are dispersed. Some form of a phased release of the frozen funds has widespread support, including from members of the U.S. Congress, the United Nations, and prominent international aid groups, human rights groups, and women's human rights and peace groups. Beyond releasing the frozen funds, the Biden administration must also lift sanctions on Afghanistan, which have done almost nothing to incentivize the Taliban to change its policies. Instead, sanctions have unleashed a chilling effect on national and international banking in Afghanistan by shutting down access to financial services, causing dire repercussions to Afghan lives and preventing civil society groups from addressing the crisis. While the U.S. Treasury Department has issued piecemeal general licenses aimed at enabling civil society organizations to continue their work in Afghanistan, these necessary but insufficient steps have failed to address the financial access issues caused by sanctions, let alone the liquidity crisis caused by freezing Afghanistan's foreign reserves. There is room for honest debate about precisely how, not if, these frozen funds should be returned to the people of Afghanistan, and which, if any, sanctions should remain in place. However, there is no room or time to cling to a status quo that is starving Afghanistan's people and its economy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.